The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Perfectly Printed People by Joseph Ellis. She looks so much like me. Her face features my small dark freckles and pronounced laugh lines. When she tugs at her clinical gown, it's my stubby fingers. When she cranes her neck to look around the sterile environment, it's my dark saucer eyes that do the looking. When she touches the cold metal table at which she sits, she pulls her hand back and places it on her collarbone, just like I do when surprised. When she turns and stares at her reflection in the two-way mirror, she bears my face of intense concentration, the face I often wear even when relaxed. The only physical difference between us is her hair, the thick black mass cut into short bob by the nurse. I've decided to name her Veronica. That's not my name, because she's not me. I set before her a tray of finger foods, strawberries, miniature marshmallows, pretzel sticks, celery, orange slices, and ruffled potato chips. Each small portion rests in its own crystal dish. The meal presents a sample of colors and textures, a test to see what she'll go for. This is her first meal, after all. The printing process finished just 2 hours ago. I take a seat opposite her at the table. Take your pick, I say. Her dark eyes flutter from one option to the next, then meet mine questioningly, or perhaps suspiciously. I've been in this position before at this very same table, wondering if my doppelganger would make the same choice I would make. I can never resist strawberries, wondering if this time the printing process produced a perfect copy, a clone of absolute precision. No, not a clone. A printed person. The company was explicit on this point when they authorized the project. Clones are subject of cautionary science fiction stories. Clones threaten identities. Clones scare people. Perfectly printed people evoke the whiz-bang excitement of 3D printing with the comfort of traditional paper printing. This workshop's slogan ignores the fact that most people have no experience with 3D printing and often find paper printing a hassle. I'm just glad I don't work in marketing. Veronica lifts a marshmallow between thumb and forefinger, brings it to her snub nose, and deliberately sniffs. Then she pops it in her mouth and chews conspicuously. She tilts her head sideways. Is she learning the taste of a marshmallow or remembering it? She's the 23rd printed person assembled here in company R&D, and we're still not sure how their brains work. Veronica moves on to a celery stick. Her mouth screws up at the strong, earthy flavor, like how I react when I drink sherry. Then she tries my favorite food, a strawberry. Her eyebrows raise in recognition or pleasant surprise. Next, she nibbles down a couple of pretzel sticks, her eyes relaxed, placid. She's so much more comfortable chowing down in front of others than I am. I'm honestly jealous. Even after seeing this experiment run 23 times, it still shocks me the subtle ways in which printed people differ from their templates, not least when that template is me. I sat in the full-body scanner for 18 hours while the central computer mapped a blueprint of my mind and body. Then the printer went to work, crafting Veronica, line by line, hydrocarbon stacked on hydrocarbon, assembling bone, laying nerves and arteries, building muscle from protein. I found myself entranced as the machine stretched olive skin over this newly minted person. I designed the process from the biological side. I spent all of my 30s on this research. 4 times I've sat in the full-body scanner. 4 times I've watched the central computer manufacture a copy of myself with laser precision. Yet the process still disturbs and fascinates me. Veronica stares at a second celery stick like it's some sort of exotic insect. Then she turns her eyes toward mine, holding my gaze questioningly. She hasn't yet talked, but appears curious to move on to something more mentally stimulating. Time to see if she's ready. "Do you mind if I call you Veronica?" I ask, holding my voice as neutral as I can. She squints in puzzlement. Will she speak? Can she speak? Some prints never do. And for several moments it appears Veronica may be among those disappointments as she holds my stare with curious eyes. Finally, her lips part and she repeats the proposed name ever so slowly. Veronica. It takes her 5 seconds to speak the full name as she draws out each vowel, as if testing each sound for possible pitfalls. I like it. That's my name. And she smiles a bright, guileless smile, a smile of the sort I haven't known in so long. I feel tears tug at the edges of my eyes. In theory, Veronica should know everything I do, the proteins and facts that compose the lump of gray matter in her head match mine molecule for molecule, and the electrical impulses that course across her brain correspond to mine at the highest rate. So she should know she's my genetic double. She should know the details of the project I've managed these past 12 years. She should know that she's not the first copy of my form and essence. She should hold memories of meeting 3 previous doubles, each different from the original in surprising, unpredictable ways. She should have knowledge of advanced degrees in biology and psychology locked away deep in her mind. She should know the intimate details of the people printing project. She should know how much money is tied up in this and the potentially nefarious goals of the company's board of directors who dream of organ farms and biological servants. But prints never gain full access to these memories. They always emerge as if from long, hazy dreams. It takes a while to determine what they can recall, and some never remember how to write or speak or walk a straight line. Those unlucky prints get sent to cryostasis within a day or two. Your name is Nicolette. My nicknames and given names spell out of Veronica's mouth. I hear myself gasp. She's recalling information unprompted so quickly. Yes, those are my names. Most people call me Nico. I manage a wan smile to meet her warm one. Nico. I thought so. It just popped into my head. And she giggles, scrunching up her nose. Have I ever giggled like that? How did you like your first meal, I ask. This is a standard question, a simple test of recall and sensory interpretation. Oh, these little things? Her hand sweeps over what's left of the sample foods. I remembered to eat them, but I didn't remember them this way. And she points to her eye. But I did remember them this way, and she points to her nose. What a fascinating rate at which she's unlocking knowledge and sensory information. She's missing words, but she's already combining concepts. I have a set of questions for you. It's okay if you can't answer all of them, but I would like you to try and answer. Do you understand? She nods. If you understand, say yes. Yes. Excellent. From a folder beside me, I pull a stapled set of 5 pages with typed questions, the printout for prints, as we call it. Question number 1. Are you too cold or too hot? Veronica looks at me quizzically, then her eyebrows shoot up as if realizing some dark truth. She looks down at her arms, mostly covered by her hospital gown. She touches her wrist with the opposite hand. I think I might be cold. Is it cold in here? There's so little light. It is rather cold. I've always found the company's use of air conditioning excessive. Would you like a sweater? Like the one you're wearing? She points at my maroon pullover. Not exactly like it. Oh, she frowns. Why don't I give you mine? No, yes, she says in rapid succession. She laughs heartily and I find myself giggling, surely not unlike how she giggled earlier. Allow me 1 minute. I exit the room to swap my woolen sweater for one of the facility's white cotton ones. I lock eyes with one of the observers standing behind the two-way mirror. He's a humorless accountant named Steve, and he frowns at me. He doesn't approve of the mirth I'm sharing with my print. I return to present Veronica with her first gift. Her eyes light up, and she stares at the maroon fabric like it's a holy relic. Does she know it's our favorite article of clothing? My heart swells. This must be like how parents feel when they impress their children. Veronica lays her hands on the treasured sweater and just holds it in for many moments, then smiles at me questioningly as if to confirm that it's okay for her to wear such a precious item. I nod in encouragement. Her initial attempt to slip the sweater on proves disastrous, with her head attempting to emerge from one sleeve, then the other. We're both cackling with glee by the time I assist her in getting all her body parts in the right places. Her short, dark hair now sticks straight up from the static electricity. I sigh. What a shame that she's unofficial property of the company. We spend the next hour on additional questions from the printout. What's the most recent dream you can remember? What college classes do you remember taking? What homes have you lived in? How surprised were you to wake up in this facility? On a scale of 1 to 10, how confused are you about your current situation? And Veronica answers every question. She speaks slowly, thoughtfully. She smiles and cocks her head playfully at the more personal questions. There's something strange in witnessing this happier version of myself. Perhaps I could be this happy, too, if I so chose. She's answering the questions with enough recall that she's likely to be my second print to move up the chain. She'll advance to the play area, where computer technicians and bean counters will test what she's capable of. I feel a swelling of pride, though I don't want to let her go. I've decided not to let her go. I've been jotting down her answers, though I know it's not necessary, as Steve and company behind the glass are copying down every word. They're paying close attention, close enough that I can't stray too far from the script without them noticing. But I've been on the other side of that glass. I know the glass isn't that clear. I know the speaker system filtering sound to them isn't the best. I know how I can make Veronica mine. I take my chance, lean in slightly, and whisper while barely opening my mouth. Smash the tray, then scream. Veronica barely reacts, only her eyelashes flutter slightly. I wonder if she heard me as I prepare to ask my next question. Veronica stands and picks up the tray, still carrying its 6 little dishes, and pauses only a second before smashing it into the table. Little bits of food and crystal fly in all directions, She moves so suddenly that the shock on my face is genuine. And then she screams, a keen wail of a scream. She finds a note above middle C and maintains it while looking straight ahead. She continues screaming as security rushes in. The next few hours blur together, but I do what must be done. She's not right. We must put her in cryo preservation. I had high hopes, but there's no way she's suitable. She's a print of me. I'll fill out the paperwork and have her frozen by the end of the day. It is evening, time to check out after a difficult day. The two of us make our way across the company parking lot. Security was designed to keep snooping journalists or industrial spies from coming in. They've grown lax to the possibility that someone inside might sneak a print out. And since she looks like me, I left her in my sweater and gave her my Dodgers cap while I exited wearing the blue jumpsuit of a technician, hair in a ponytail. Everything went smoothly. Veronica left first, walking past the front desk and smiling at the intern without generating a hint of suspicion. She waits for me by an island of grass in the middle of the parking lot. I walk out without even waving to that same intern. I'm just another technician heading home. No one stopped either of us. No one ran out to meet us outside. Within a week, the security cameras will have any evidence of this erased. They might eventually notice that Veronica disappeared, but the company is so bogged down with bureaucracy, I wouldn't be shocked if they never figured out what I did. To them, Veronica is just another failed print to be stored away and dealt with once they've gotten all the legal issues ironed out. Cheaper and simpler to print more people and work with the ones that emerge deft and compliant. I hold the passenger door on my Integra open for Veronica. She stares at me quizzically, but eventually takes the seat without further prompting. She even fastens her seatbelt without needing to copy me. Now we're driving home. Veronica stares bemusedly at trees and apartment buildings. She smirks at an accident we pass. A Volvo driver hit a post office box. She never once asks why we're doing what we're doing. I feel comfortable enough to roll down the windows. Veronica sticks her head halfway out like a cautious dog. Her short, stiff hair barely sways in the wind. Surely this is happiness. We arrive home. Veronica follows me up to my apartment on the third floor, stomping on each wooden stair with increasing force, reveling in the vibrations. We come to the door. Time to meet your other roommates, I say as I put the key in the lock. Bernice comes running as the door opens, her long, wild hair flying all around her. Bernice doesn't like to talk, but she approaches and shakes my hand, then Veronica's with enthusiasm. Veronica's eyes grow wide. She appears overwhelmed by this quick-moving stranger who appears so similar to both of us. Perhaps I should have done more to prepare her. Bernice runs to grab a sheaf of papers from the coffee table, which she presses into my hands. Oh, how pretty, I say, like a doting mother. She's painted images from the park. Maybe we'll all visit the park one morning if you're up for it. Veronica looks over my shoulder and her countenance softens as she looks over the bright, skillfully painted watercolors of flowers and fountains. I took art classes in college and showed some promise. That was before I decided on a more lucrative major. Seeing Bernice develop a skill I'd abandoned feels so gratifying. Another one of us. Aren't you afraid of having so many mouths to feed? Vera, my cleverest and most cynical print, says from the far corner of the living room. She and Veronica lock eyes from across the space. My own eyes flip back and forth between my doppelgangers. From the new enthusiastic print with short hair wearing my favorite sweater to the dry, sarcastic original print across the room. Vera's hair is even shorter, trimmed down to a crew cut. I suspect for reasons of individuation. She's like how I was before joining the corporate world. By now, Beatrice has noticed the staring contest. She playfully tries to intercede, but Veronica and Vera simply stare over her shoulders, their eyes only for each other. I worry for a moment that they might be instant enemies. I was wrong to worry, for slowly, almost in mirror image, they start to smile, turning their mouths from slight smirks to wide grins of small pearlescent teeth. A year back, when I first brought Vera home, smuggled her out in fear, they meant to destroy my beautifully rebellious print. I worried for months about what might happen, about the moral and legal risks of creating and then stealing a copy of myself. Slowly, I came around to the idea that this was my life's work, my purpose, and the source of my future happiness. I will continue to request prints of myself, then smuggle those prints out. I will teach them and learn from them. I will have the sisters and friends denied to me by being born an only child who studied and worked too hard. Maybe one day I'll reunite with my second print, Oletta, who graduated to the playroom. They're all me. You're all me, Veronica says slowly, deliberately. We're all the same, and we're all different, Vera says, mimicking Veronica's cadence. Pizza? Bernice suggests and gestures toward the kitchen where three varieties of frozen deluxe topping pizzas wait. A good second meal, Veronica says. Together we move to the kitchen to select our dinner. Continuity States of America by Jaden Shin. They assessed me for the first time when I was 3 months old. I didn't remember it, of course, but the file did. The file remembered everything. It said I was calm. It said my pulse stayed even as the nurse lifted my arm, as the scanner passed over my scalp like a blessing, warm and humming. The file noted that I did not cry, that my eyes tracked the light, that my breathing never faltered. It recorded this as a promise. By 15, my score was finalized, printed in clean letters that did not tremble. Mother index, gold. Household risk, moderate. Citizenship, provisional. The guidance counselor congratulated me in her office, where the walls were painted a soothing blue meant to soothe the heart. Her smile was bright and tight. "You're valuable," she said, and the word sat between us, heavy and polished. She said I should be proud. She said I was valuable. She did not say to whom. They stopped calling me a girl after that. In the reports, I became a future unit, a projected asset, a line on a chart with a body attached. My name remained on the forms, but it felt thinner, like ink applied too lightly, as though it might fade if no one pressed hard enough. When I asked my father what it meant, he looked at me with a smile that did not reach his eyes. "It means," he said carefully, "you'll never be left alone." He said it quietly, like a prayer you don't want overheard. The walls were listening. In the continuity states of America, even silence had ears. We didn't have borders anymore, at least not the old kind. No flags snapping above checkpoint tents, no long lines of cars under floodlights. The government said borders were inefficient, too visible, too cruel, in a way that made people angry in public. So they replaced them with something quieter, permission zones. The country became a map of invisible fences. You couldn't see them until you bumped into one. A blue street becomes white without changing its pavement. A hospital door becomes forbidden. A school becomes a wall. A grocery store becomes an accusation. Your phone carried your pass, and your pass carried your life. When you stepped where you shouldn't, it didn't always stop you in the moment. Sometimes it waited. Sometimes it let you cross and then punished you at night when you were asleep and not watching the world rearrange itself around you. People called it optimization. I called it quiet imprisonment. Our apartment was in the blue zone, but it sat too close to the gray zone to be comfortable. The streets near us had cameras on the light poles and drones that floated like fat insects, their shadows skimming the sidewalk. Some mornings the transit gates opened for my pass, some mornings they didn't. No explanation, just a red blink and a polite message. Access pending review. My father used to say that was the worst part. Not the denial, not the punishment, the waiting. Waiting teaches you to obey. It makes you behave. My father, Elias Kwan, had been truth certified once, before the updates, before the year they decided the old frameworks were destabilizing. He taught history, real history, with dates that stayed put and events that didn't dissolve when they became inconvenient. I remember when he taught my friend Alex and me about world wars, plagues, dictatorships. Now those events are forbidden to mention, even in whispers. When his certification expired, he didn't reapply. I can't swear to forget things I still remember, he told me. He said it like a joke, but his eyes were tired. After that, our household score began to drift downward, slowly at first, then faster, like a pulled thread unraveling fabric. The night his status dropped from provisional to removable, there were no sirens, no knock at the door. We found out because the grocery scanner wouldn't read his fingerprint, because the apartment locked him out while he stood in the hallway holding his coat, the door blinking red like it was embarrassed. I remembered the look on his face. It wasn't fear. It was recognition. He tried his phone. The screen showed his name, then a gray bar, then nothing. Resolved, he read aloud. His voice made the word sound like a joke. Resolved means what, I asked. It means, he said, they're done with you. He looked at me then, and for a second his eyes were sharp and young with panic. And they're not done with you. The maternal continuity office summoned me the next morning. The building sat on a white zone district. White zones are bright in a way that make you feel dirty for existing in shadow. The doors opened soundlessly, and the floors reflected my face faintly, as if reminding me to watch myself. A woman in a gray suit led me to a room with no windows and offered me tea, which I did not drink. Director Addison Mercer arrived exactly on time. She was smaller than I expected. That's how her power often looks in person, compact, tidy, carried like a purse. Her hair was silver, cut neatly at the jaw. Her suit was the color of a dove's wing. She smiled with her whole face, practiced and warm, the way people do when they have already made their decision. Mara, she said, you must be overwhelmed. I nodded. It was safer than speaking. In our world, words leave fingerprints. You're aware of your index classification? Yes. Gold, she said gently. That's what makes it meaningful. Meaningful like sacred, like inevitable. She slid a tablet across the table. On it was my projection, my life reduced to curves and probabilities, risks plotted neatly beside value. Your household has become unstable, she continued. Your father's noncompliance creates risk. He taught, I said. The words felt sharp in my mouth. He remembered, she corrected. The room felt smaller after that. We can correct this, Director Mercer said. Continuity allows for intervention when value is threatened. What intervention? I asked, though I already knew. We prefer the term placement, she said. You would be transferred to a white zone residence. Full protection, maternal care, your father's status would be reevaluated. You mean separation. Separation implies harm, she said softly. And if I refuse? Her smile thinned. Refusal indicates emotional volatility. From gold to something else, to silver if I was lucky, to bronze if I was not, to ash, perhaps, if the system decided my value was less than my risk and meant non-viable, which was a word for people the way expired was a word for milk. We don't do anything, she said when I asked if they would downgrade me. The index reflects the truth. Truth, in her mouth, sounded like a briefing statement. I want to see my father. He is being processed. Where? He is being resolved. Outside, the air felt thinner, or maybe that was just me. My past flickered as I crossed back into the blue zone. The sunlight was the same, but it felt monitored. Alex was waiting near the transit rail. He had always been careful. You shouldn't be out, he said. There's an audit sweep. I can't go home. I told him enough, not everything. You have to cooperate, he said. They're going to take me. They're going to protect you. I laughed. It came out wrong. You shouldn't react like that, he said. Like it's wrong? Yes, he said. Wrong was a status category. I didn't know when Alex filed the concern notice. It arrived as a wellness flag, smiling punctuation and gentle phrasing. By morning, my status had updated. Placement approved. Household dissolved. Father resolved. I stood outside our apartment until a neighbor passed and looked away. The system doesn't need guards if it can teach people to look elsewhere. The care house was in the white zone. Inside, gold girls moved quietly, discussing nutrient ratios and schedules. Posters lined the walls. Stability is mercy. Motherhood is continuity. My room was small. The window didn't open. That night, I pressed my forehead to the glass and thought of my father's ink-stained hands, his voice insisting the past mattered. The state had renamed him already. Resolved. Director Mercer visited again. Your future is more important than your past, she said. I stared at my hands. In the mirror, my gold band gleamed like jewelry, like a shackle. This was how the regime survived. Not with villains. Not with villains, but with helpers. I lay awake, repeating forbidden words like a rosary. Border, home, choice, father. Then I whispered just once, remember. And in that small, disobedient word, I felt the first crack in the glass. An Alien Green Chile Run by Daniel P. Douglas. Welcome back to Undisclosed Skies, episode 241. I'm your host, Manny Gallegos, coming to you live from I-25, somewhere south of truth or consequences in the middle of absolutely nowhere. And folks, tonight might be the night. I said that into the microphone. The microphone was clipped to my sun visor, plugged into the recorder on the dash. The recorder was in my truck. The truck was doing 83 in the 75 zone because I was running late to meet an alien. I should clarify, I didn't know I was running late to meet an alien. At that point, I was running late to stand in a dark field for 2 hours, see nothing, drive home, edit out the parts where I sneezed, and upload the episode to a platform that would deliver it to my 13 subscribers, one of whom was my abuela, one of whom was me, because I like to check the audio quality. The other 11 were, statistically speaking, probably bots. 5 years I'd been doing this. 5 years of chasing lights, filling FOIA requests, driving to places Google Maps had to think about before it gave me directions. I had covered every mile of New Mexico sky and found exactly as much as every other podcaster in the UFO space, which was nothing, but I found it with more enthusiasm. The cab smelled of green chili, not the metaphorical kind, not the spiritual essence of New Mexico that tourists talk about after they spend a weekend in Santa Fe. My abuela had sent me home with a bag of roasted green chili last Sunday, and even though I'd put it in the fridge that night, the smell had soaked into the seat cushion and the headliner and was never coming out. Doña Rosalinda Gallegos didn't care about UFOs. She cared about whether I was eating enough, whether the chili skins were blistered right, and whether I had a girlfriend yet, in that order. I told her the podcast was about to break through. She told me the Hatch Sandias needed another week on the vine. The tip had come in by email 3 days ago. No name, no return address that led anywhere. Just a Proton Mail account in 2 sentences. Lights drop into the chili fields south of Hatch every August during peak harvests. Go at 2 a.m. I had chased 100 tips like this, but this one felt different. Not, I saw lights. Not, something weird happened. Just a time, a place, and a crop. Chile fields. August, 2 a.m. I checked the clock on the dashboard. 1:45 a.m. The exit came up fast. I killed the headlights before I turned off on the highway because that's what you do when you're trying to be stealthy in a 2014 Tacoma with a muffler that sounds like a dog clearing its throat. The dirt road ran straight between 2 fields. Chili plants on both sides, rows and rows of them. Big gyms, by the look of it, heavy with fruit, plants that made Hatch the center of the universe if you measured the universe by the right criteria. I pulled over, killed the engine, and sat in silence. The field stretched into a darkness so complete that the stars looked like someone had punched holes in the ceiling. I grabbed the recorder and the microphone, stuffed my phone in my pocket and picked up the pencil and notebook I kept for sketches and the flashlight I'd promised myself I'd replace the batteries in. All right, undisclosed skies, I said to nobody, let's go see what's out there. I left the flashlight in the truck. The batteries were dead. Of course they were. The chile rolls came up to my waist, thick with fruit on both sides, close enough to brush my arms as I walked between them. I had my recorder running, whispering into the microphone like a nature documentarian who wandered into the wrong show. I'm approximately 200 yards from the road. The field is dark, very dark. I can smell the chili ripening on the plants. For the record, the ambient conditions are clear skies, no wind, maybe 75 degrees. If there's anything out here, it's picked a beautiful night. There wasn't going to be anything out here. I'd known it since the email came in, the same way I'd known it every other time. But I kept walking, because the moment I stopped walking towards something, I'd have to figure out what I was walking away from. And 5 years of nothing is a lot easier to carry when you're still moving. I came around a dirt berm at the far end of the field. I stopped. The craft sat in the furrows like it had grown there, 30 feet across, maybe more, settled into the rows at a slight angle, the way a car sinks into a sandy shoulder. No landing gear that I could see, no ramp, no doorway, no blinking lights, just a shape that did not belong in a Chile field. Lit from underneath by a color I have spent every day since trying to name. Not blue, not green, not white. Something my eyes could see, but my brain refused to file. I wish I could tell you I was brave. What I actually did was stand there with my mouth open while my hands forgot how hands worked. The recorder slipped. I caught it across my chest. It was real. The figure stood on the far side of the craft between two rows of big gems. The light from underneath spilled out across the furrows, bright enough to turn the chili leaves silver and show me everything. It wasn't shaped the way decades of movies had promised me it would be. I can tell you it had limbs, and I can tell you it moved with them. And after that, my description falls apart because your brain keeps trying to match something genuinely new to something old and failing. A new color, walking around, pulling up chili plants. That's what it was doing. Pulling up chili plants by the root, calm and methodical. The way my abuela works her garden on a Saturday morning. Not picking the pods, the whole plant, roots and all. It would grip the base of the plant, ease it out of the dirt, shake the soil off the roots, and place the whole thing into an opening in the craft's left side. Then it moved to the next one, grip, pull, shake, place. It had been doing this for a while. I stood there, 30 seconds maybe. It felt like years. Then I did the only thing I knew how to do. I raised the microphone. This is Manny Gallegos, Undisclosed Skies, episode 241, and I am looking at something in a Chile field south of Hatch, New Mexico. I am looking at a craft and a being, and it is, I swallowed, it is harvesting green chili. The alien did not look up. I said it louder. I identified myself again, stated my coordinates, described the craft, described the being, and described the chili plants disappearing one by one into the hull. I was narrating first contact with the enthusiasm of a man who had rehearsed this moment in his bathroom mirror for half a decade. It pulled another plant, shook the dirt off, placed it inside, and it was busy. I approached, not fast, not slow, the way you'd approach a coyote eating out of a dumpster, interested, cautious, and fully aware that you are the least important person in this situation. "Hi," I said. "Hello, I'm Manny. I come in peace." That's probably your line, but I figured somebody should say it. Nothing. I tried Spanish, I tried Navajo, or what I remembered of Navajo from a community collective, college elective I mostly slept through. I tried math, I said prime numbers and listed a few, which in retrospect was less impressive than I'd hoped, because I stalled out after 23. It moved to the next row. Fine, if it wouldn't talk, I'd document. I pulled out my phone and opened the camera. The screen turned into something that looked like television static had a seizure. No image, no interface, just a wall of visual noise and a high whine from the speaker that made my back teeth hum. I killed the app, reopened it, same thing. Turned the phone off and back on, and the phone restarted, showing me my lock screen for half a second and went black, dead. The phone I'd charged to 92% in the truck was now a glass brick. The recorder had been running this whole time. I'd bought it at a pawn shop in Deming's, specially for situations where primary equipment failed, which happened to me often enough that I'd started budgeting for it. I checked the playback and heard nothing but a low, steady hum, like someone dragging a cello bar across the bottom of the ocean. My voice was gone. The alien's movements were gone. Just the hum, fat and featureless, filling the entire recording. The red light still flickered on the front. The thing thought it was working. The notebook. I still had the notebook. I flipped it open, pulled the pencil from the spiral binding, and started sketching the craft. Three lines in, the pencil snapped. Not the lead, the pencil. The wood split lengthwise, clean down the middle, without waiting for any reason to fall apart. I stared at the two halves in my hand. I had sharpened that pencil before I left the house. I tried the phone again. It turned on this time, which felt like progress. I opened the notes app and typed six words before the screen froze and the phone shut off for good. It's pulling up the... That was my evidence. Five words and an article, reaching for a noun that never came. No photo, no audio, no video, no sketch. Six words in a notes app on a phone that didn't work. Through all of this, the alien harvested Chile. It didn't react to my phone, my recorder, my broken pencil, or my increasingly loud suggestions that it hold still. It worked the rows with the patience of someone who had been doing this job since before my family name existed in this valley. I had chased this moment all my life. I was inside it, and I had nothing to show for it except a dead phone, a broken pencil, and a recorder full of hum. I just stood there and let the weight of it settle. 5 years. 5 years of driving and waiting and talking into the dark. And the one time it mattered, I couldn't hold on to any of it. Not a frame. Not a word. I felt the back of my throat go tight, and I looked away from the alien because I didn't want to cry in front of whatever it was. The alien turned toward the final row of big gyms, the longest row, the fullest, heavy, with late August fruit. And I did something that was either the bravest or the stupidest thing I've ever done, which in my life is a competitive category. I stepped into the row and blocked its path. Without a plan, I just knew that when it finished and left, I would be standing alone in a field with nothing. No proof, no story, no validation. 5 years of my life would collapse into an anecdote I'd tell at parties that nobody would believe, and the parties were hypothetical because I didn't get invited to parties. Wait, I said, please, just wait. The alien stopped. For the first time since I'd walked into that field, it acknowledged me. Something happened that I can't describe with any word that would hold up in court. It didn't speak. It didn't project images into my mind, because that's a movie thing and this wasn't a movie. What it did was closer to what happens when you walk into your abuela's kitchen and the smell of roasting chile tells you everything you need to know without a single word. You just understand. The information arrives whole, like it was always there and you just hadn't looked at it yet. Here is what I understood. It had been coming here for a long time. Longer than my family, longer than the Pueblo ruins on the mesa above the field. It came for the chile, the way you'd cross town for one restaurant that makes the thing you can't get anywhere else, except the town was a spiral arm of the Milky Way, and the restaurant was a field in southern New Mexico. Nothing else in the galaxy tastes like it. This altitude, this soil, this sun, and we just grew it. Roasted it in parking lots, stuffed it into burritos, hung it in ristas on our porches, and never once looked up from the plate. The alien didn't care about me. It didn't care about my podcasts, about disclosure, about whether humanity was ready for contact. It was here for the same reason my abuela drove to the farmer's market in Hatch every August. The chili was worth the trip. Something shifted. Not in the field. Not in the sky, in me. It was in the dirt under my boots. It was in the smell that would never leave my truck. It was in every jar of roasted green that my abuela had ever pressed into my hands and told me to eat before it went bad. I stepped aside and just watched. It finished the last row in about 10 minutes. Methodical, calm. It loaded the final plants and then it disappeared into craft without a sound. The craft lifted out of the field straight up. No thrusts, no roar, no displaced air. The chili leaves on the remaining plants didn't move. It rose until it was the size of a star, and then it was a star, and then it wasn't. I stood in the dark, in the dirt, in a field with gaps and the rows like missing teeth. I smelled green chile. From my truck, probably, or from the broken stems where the plants had been pulled, or from somewhere I couldn't explain and didn't need to. After walking back through the field, I got in the truck. I didn't call the media, post on Reddit, or phone the one friend who would have believed me. Believing me wasn't the point anymore. I drove home to Las Cruces. The sun came up over the Organs and filled the valley with a light so clean it made you understand why people stay here even when the rest of the country forgets we exist. I sat in my truck outside my apartment for a long time before going inside. I set up the microphone and recorded the rest of episode 241. It wasn't about the encounter. It was about green chile, whether it comes from, what makes it different from every other pepper on the planet, and why the people who grow it have always known that without needing to be told. I talked about my abuela, about the way she chars the skin on the open burner and turns them with her bare fingers because she says tongs bruise the flesh, about the way the whole house smells like the thing the universe crosses light years to collect, about the way she has never once been impressed by the sky because she's too busy paying attention to what's growing out of the ground. I didn't mention the alien. I didn't need to. I called my abuela that afternoon. She asked if I was eating enough. I told her I was. She said, good. The sandias were ready. Come get them Sunday. I said, I'd be there.